Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, South Bay Spotlight, on July 13th, 2017. Live, love, laugh, and leave a legacy. That's what we do here in the South Bay of Los Angeles, and it's a beautiful place to do just that.
The South Bay Show is brought to you by the Academy of Foreign Languages. If you have any interest in learning a new language or brushing up on existing language skills, you should know about the Academy of Foreign Languages. Located in Palos Verdes, the Academy of Foreign Languages specializes in the art of communication. Their mission is to provide the finest language instruction possible. They recognize that each student has distinctive needs and craft their teaching technique to optimize an individual's particular learning skills. At the Academy of Foreign Languages, they strive to create a comfortable environment conducive to learning. So whether you're learning a new language or would simply like to converse in your native tongue, the Academy of Foreign Languages can accommodate you. For additional information, visit their website at academyofforeignlanguages.com, that's all spelled out, or call 310-975-4133.
I'm your host, Joe Terry, and you can read all about our many adventures on Facebook at facebook.com/The South Bay Show. Persistence, passion, principle, and purpose, that's what we talk about here on the South Bay Show. And of course, I'm not alone, because of our great partnership with South Bay by Jackie.com and executive producer of the South Bay Show, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today?
Oh, Joe, it's so good to be back, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it's been a long time. We were off the entire last week because of the holiday.
I know. It just throws me. So we were off. So it was 2, 7 days, 8, 9. So we've been off like 12 days, and it always throws me, you know, it always throws me just this morning, remembering to set up the board and, you know, all this other stuff. It just throws me being off that long. But it was a crazy week last week. A lot of people left town, very, very quiet around town, a lot of people traveling.
Right.
But it was a good week. It was a good week. We got a lot done.
A lot of things got, you know, sort of planned for the future.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I made the announcement this morning in my weekend guide. My weekend guide went out this morning, did you see that?
I see it. I'm watching it. I'm looking at it now, and it kind of brings a tear to my eye.
Oh, I think you're a little too emotional, Joe. Just real quickly, we're not going to get into it, but you and I are starting a new program called South Bay by Jackie Presents. It's going to be a video platform, which is completely new for us, so it's very exciting. And, we start that this week, and we're going to, I believe, post the first program this weekend. So it's something new and different, and we're going to put it out there and see what people think about it. So I'm kind of excited about it. But
yeah.
I'm even more excited about today's show.
Today's show is amazing, and of course, it goes right along the line of many shows that we've done about live music here in the South Bay, and it continues. But this is a pretty special guest with some heavy connections, right, Jackie?
Heavy duty. Yes, very heavy.
Heavy. Jackie, who's our guest today?
Our guest this morning is composer and musical architect Peter T. Myers. Now, with 5 decades of experience in the music and entertainment industries, Peter joyfully crafts detailed compositions, illuminating lively stories through counterpoint, textured harmonies, and striking rhythms. He has worked extensively with many gifted artist groups and professionals, including Sarah Vaughan, Sammy Davis Jr., Marvin Gaye, Diana Ross, Barbara Streisand, Doc Severinsen, Olivia Newton-John, the London Symphony Orchestra, Placido Domingo, and the list goes on and on. His diverse work on film, television and theater products demonstrates his natural ability to interpret the voices of many different types of artists and to create exceptional music that perfectly expresses a specific story and genuine feeling. Originally from Manchester, England, Peter was brought up in a family of musicians and attended the prestigious Royal College of Music in London. He moved to Los Angeles in the early 60s, hoping to become a composer in Hollywood. His love of pop and theater music deepened as he observed what visionaries like Duke Ellington, Horace Silver, Stephen Sondheim, and George Gershwin were doing with harmony, rhythm, and dynamics. His career took off in the late 1960s and led to a string of successes working with renowned artists, directors, and musicians on groundbreaking projects. Peter was the music director for Della Reese's daily television show and later worked as the arranger for the Carol Burnett Show, the Sonny and Cher Show, and the Academy Awards for a number of years, where he wrote for Tom Jones, Natalie Cole, Steve Lawrence, Sammy Davis, Tony Randall, and more. He had an extensive partnership with Oscar-winning composer Bill Conti, who hired him to provide orchestrations for a dozen films, among them An Unmarried Woman, Rocky III, The Wiz, For Your Eyes Only, and Private Benjamin. For 30 years, he composed for Aaron Spelling, 20th Century Fox, Universal, Lorimar, and Viacom. He provided weekly scores for the wildly popular television shows, including Dynasty, Falcon's Crest, and Jake and the Fat Man. Now, after all these years, Peter has returned to his jazz roots with the formation of the Peter Myers Orchestra. Since its inception, he has written over 100 arrangements of works by Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn, Michael Jackson, Henry Mancini, Leonard Bernstein, Phil Collins, Mike Stoller, Aaron Copland, Bill Monroe, John Lewis, and more. Now, the Peter Myers Orchestra will be playing at the historic Lighthouse Cafe in Hermosa Beach this Sunday, July 16th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And this morning, Joe, we get to pick the brain of this legendary musician and listen to some of what attendees can expect this weekend. Welcome to the program, Peter. We are thrilled you could join us this morning.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Where do we start? I mean, first of all, of course, your focus is the fabulous Peter Myers Orchestra right now. I mean, that must be an amazing, you get up and you go to work and you get to do this. I'm sure that you're just as excited about this today as anything you've ever done in your career. But Peter, we have to talk about your career because it is such an amazing resume. So take us back. Where did it begin for Peter Myers?
Well, I would say there are probably about three main stages. One is a boy being around musicians, not always professional, but nevertheless excellent musicians. At that point, I wanted to be a star soccer player, but that was not going to work out. Being around the music people, it really was those were my formative years. And during that time, my ears were listening and observing to everything that was going on around me. And I would say that's the very beginning. Later,
were your parents musicians?
No. Let's put it this way: there's a very famous ballet school in London called the Sadler's Wells, the ballet company, I should say. And they had a satellite school in Manchester, and Mrs. Myers, my mother, was the piano player there. So many budding ballerinas, and some of them became kind of semi-famous. She was the pianist for that school. My father was a terrific pianist, but I think lacked the confidence to do it professionally, and so he did other work. But my paternal grandfather was, in his day, I'll give you approximate years, from, say, 1905 to 1920, was a fairly successful composer of what they, I guess he called theater music. He did pretty well at it, you know, and I learned a lot from him. Not what notes to play, it was mainly what to leave out. And those are my formative years.
Yeah, that's quite a start. world famous, potentially world famous ballerinas. That's great.
Yeah.
So what's phase two?
Yeah, well, I'd say phase two would be when I left home when I was about 17. It may take a minute to explain this, but it's interesting. They had a draft in England at that point, and had I waited until I was drafted, I would have been put in this one particular army branch that was already in Kenya fighting the Mau Mau, and that didn't appeal to me very much. So it's the truth. You can't make this stuff up. This trumpet player friend of mine said, if we were to go to London and audition for one of the staff bands, it would be like the Marine Corps band in Washington, D.C. And so I went to London. I auditioned for the band of the Grenadier Guards. And so I got in there. So that was my draft. I was in the band of the Grenadier Guards. And that was a great learning experience because there were some excellent musicians in that band. And plus, I was in London and around everything that was going on there musically. And so, therefore, there were more formative years. My little brain was absorbing all of this stuff as fast as I could. And then when I got out of the Army, then I started playing in bands and I started writing arrangements. Whether they were any good or not, I don't know, but at least I was attempting to do it. That would be phase two.
Now,
and then very quickly to phase three.
I can never discount how important it is for an army to have a good sounding band, right?
Right.
Yeah, sure.
No, seriously, all those great marches and stuff. I mean, that's incredible. That's incredible. So, did you serve there for the entire length of the wars?
Well, this was the when I was there. That would be say in the late 50s. We just did ceremonial duty. That's what we did. We played Buckingham Palace like every other day. We did ceremonial duties. Now, needless to say, in a public broadcast like this, there are a lot of things that I can't bring up. That in a private situation, around a coffee table or something like that, I could keep you enthralled with stories of things that happened in Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle, but I can't do that today. So just
if
you bear that in mind.
That's another show. We're booking another show right now.
That's right.
Exactly.
Right. That's right. Expose, the Peter Myers expose on the Royals
coming up this
fall. now, Peter, but I want to step back a moment. In phase two, what we're talking about is something I've heard many musicians sort of recount their history, and one of the things that is unique about, not unique really about music, but very interesting about music is how often musicians will refer to, well, this was a great formative experience. There were some great musicians that
Absolutely.
I worked with, and I
Yes.
learned a lot from them. Tell us, what did you learn from some of these musicians that you didn't learn from your mom, or you didn't learn from practice? What is it about playing with others that
bear this in mind, that both my parents, in fact, everybody in the family, they were piano players. I was a trombone player. Yeah. And the big difference is that piano players, for the most part, play alone and they practice alone. As a trombone player, I mean, I played the piano, but I was much more enthralled in playing the trombone. Trombone players are like other players. Do you play in ensembles? And that's what I learned was ensemble playing. That, in other words, you're playing in a section and we have to play together. And no matter what my ideas may be, I can't freelance. We have to play together. So your question is a terrific question because it gets right to the heart of it all. It's ensemble playing. And some of the greatest music ever done, ever recorded, should I say, or performed, what makes it so great, sure, the players are wonderful, but it's the quality of the ensemble playing. And that's what I would say I really learned, and that helped me as a composer and arranger later was to be very, very aware of ensemble. And thank you for the question, because it goes to the core of it all. I should say.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Can I say this also?
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say that. Just to mention a couple of names. Have you ever heard of a jazz club in London called the Ronnie Scott Club? Well, anyway, it's the place in London where jazz is played. And in the early days, I was sort of I hung around with those guys, and as such, I learned from them because they were I was always like a wunderkind, and these guys were older than me, and I was like a sponge. I was just absorbing everything, and in a nutshell, pretty well absorbing it and saying, knowing what to do and what not to do. You know, that would be it.
Okay. Fantastic. So now you're out of the service and you're trying to find your next gig. What is that? The big move across the pond?
No, not yet. Because I became successful. No, I became reasonably known as an arranger over there in London. And one of the shows that I would write arrangements on would be the equivalent of, say, the Ed Sullivan Show. It was called Sunday Night at the Palladium. And usually it was a one-hour variety show, and I would write arrangements for, performing dogs or, it could be anything. I mean, that was the whole thing. You become a master of all these different styles because there's no point in trying to write a string quartet for a guy who has a parrot. I mean, it makes no sense. So I learned very quickly from the old pros who were working on the show. I figured, we do it this way. Okay, that way I'll stay employed. So one of the things that happened, and I think this was the turning point, and that is that from time to time, the what they used to call top of the bill or the number one act that would be on this Sunday night at the Palladium would be a visiting American star. And they would bring arrangements with them, and they were usually pretty good. I mean, I thought, you know what? I can do that. And I sensed that I was in the minor leagues and that over here was the major league. So that it took me about a year and a half to finally pluck up the courage and pull up my roots and come over here and just throw my hat in the ring. But that was it. That was the turning point. Let's say, for instance, Lena Horne. Sammy Davis was on the show, and I do remember he had a music director named Morty Stevens, who I humbly chit-chatted with back then in London, and I remember saying to him, one of these days, I said, I'm going to go to Hollywood and see what I can do, and Morty encouraged me. He said, absolutely. He said, you'd be like the rest of us, which it sounded very convincing. But the next morning when I'd wake up, I wasn't quite so convinced. but anyway, that was about it. And so therefore, I took the plunge and came over here with my little family, my wife and a little 2-year-old daughter, and came to Hollywood and asked me any questions you want now about that.
Hollywood.
Yeah,
the big move to Hollywood was that for a job or for
a company? No, absolutely. I was an immigrant. I was absolutely an immigrant. I had a green card. By the way, it took 1 year of going back and forth to the United States Embassy in Grosvenor Square, London, before I finally got my papers. You know, it's. I just didn't come across the border. I had to go through a lot of stuff. And as I said, I'm sorry?
I was saying it's a process.
No, go on.
It's a process. You just don't But you knew people. You knew some people here, correct?
Yeah. I would say a handful of people I did know. It wasn't like I, you know, I just looked in the supermarket and met somebody there. No, no, no. I did know some people and gave it a shot. Now, here's, guess where I got my first job?
What are
we talking about?
Give us a hint, please.
Well, I got my first job in the South Bay.
Oh, wow.
at the lighthouse. At the lighthouse.
Really?
No.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say the late summer of 1964, I played at the lighthouse with, and they were called the Howard Rumsey Lighthouse All-Stars. And what had happened is the group that consisted of piano, bass, and drums, a trumpet, and a saxophone. Well, the trumpet player was a gentleman named Bobby Bryant, a terrific player. And I had gone down, and the saxophone player was named Bob Cooper. And Bobby Bryant evidently had just was, let's see this way. I sat in a couple of times there, and I seemed to have done reasonably well. And so I got a call from Bobby Bryant a number of times. He said, you know, he said, I'm starting to work at NBC and they like you down at the lighthouse. Can you fill in for me? Which I would do. And so eventually he took a full-time job at NBC. He was in the staff orchestra over in Burbank. And so I worked for maybe about 3 months at the lighthouse. That was my first job.
Wow. Wow. Right. Well, that's amazing. But so let me just mention again that the Peter Myers Orchestra will be playing at the Lighthouse Cafe this Sunday, July 16th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. That's the brunch hour, which is always a ton of fun down there on Pierre Avenue. That's amazing. That's full circle, isn't it, Peter?
Absolutely, Jackie. That is absolutely full circle. The first excuse me. The first time I did it, you know, the lady that books us, her name is Gloria Cadena, and she is a piece of history when it comes to music. And her late husband, Ozzie Cadena, where he recorded so many jazz musicians over the years, and she's fabulous. Gloria's fabulous. So the first time that I worked there, I said to the audience, I said, you know, if these walls could talk, there'd be thousands of stories here. I mean, the place is legendary.
Well, you know something, Joe, a while back, last year sometime, there was an exhibit regarding, it was about the history, the musical history of the Lighthouse. And for the life of me, I'm forgetting where it was, but they gathered together all these photographs of all of the musicians that have played at the Lighthouse. You know, since what is it, the 20s?
I think they started right after World War II, about 45, 46, something like that. That's when it started.
Okay, all right. Yeah, there was a great exhibition. I saw it, and for the life of me, I'm sorry, I'm completely blanking on where it was, but I can find it out later. Yeah, there's quite a history there.
Quite. Now, I want to get back to Peter, I want to get back to this song. We have a song that the fabulous Peter Myers Orchestra has done recently, and it all gets back to, as well, the concept of arrangement. This song, Try a Little Tenderness, was written by Jimmy Campbell, Reg Connolly, and Harry Woods, first recorded in 1932 by the Ray Noble Orchestra. Both Ruth Etting and Bing Crosby recorded it in 1933. Very familiar. And it also has a great history that a strings-heavy instrumental version played over the opening credits of the 1964 Stanley Kubrick film Dr. Strangelove. But tell me.
No kidding.
Tell me about this
song.
I
didn't know that. Well,
isn't that interesting? Tell me. Try a little.
It's fabulous.
Tell me about
it. I do know that it's an old song, as songs go. It goes back to the 30s.
Yeah.
And the balladeers of the day, as you said, people like Bing Crosby, and I'm not looking down my nose at this. I'm just saying those were the things of the day, recorded this song. Now, if we fast forward, and I'm ballparking it a little bit, in the 60s, one of the very popular singer was around Los Angeles, actually became popular nationally, by the name of Sam Cooke. He recorded this, and his version would be very different from a Bing Crosby version. It was more of like a black church version, really. That's about the best way I can describe it. And it became fairly popular. Now, I say fairly popular. However, following that, a gentleman by the name of Otis Redding,
mm-hmm. right.
he was due to make a fresh album, and one of the A&R men suggested that he did this song, and he sort of resisted. He didn't really want to do it. And when it was pointed out to him that Sam Cooke had a fairly successful version, he kind of relented and said, well, okay. And the rest is history, because it became a huge smash hit. So it's when these things happen, you know, it's like the treatment of a song. For instance, I'll give you an example, one from the movies, Singing in the Rain. Before Gene Kelly did it, it was just another song, but the orchestrator, fabulous orchestrator at MGM, a gentleman by the name of Conrad Salinger, came up with all of a sudden it was huge. You see, you never know. You never can tell. So here's, we'll go back to Otis Redding and the Try a Little Tenderness. So the advent with my jazz orchestra, which I have to say, can I just comment on this? Because I did, I wrote music for directors and producers forever, where with all due respect to every one of them, they were the boss. And I understood that, you know, the thing that I'm getting paid to do something, I have to make this person happy. So when I retired from all of that, which I did retire, I said, you know, I've done this long enough. I've 35 years. I mean, that's, When you started reading that stuff from my bio, I was exhausted already.
That's heavily edited too. Trust me.
Oh no,
that's as short as I could get it.
Right. Well, so anyway, the 35 years, and my wife said, you know, I told her, I said, look, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to be like Sandy Koufax retiring. You just say, look, I'm not going to do this anymore. But she said, you have to do something musically. So I decided to do this. And as you commented earlier, Joe, this is like my life now. I mean, I love everything about it. And there's an oblique comment that I would make about being a musician or a composer / arranger in Hollywood or Los Angeles. And that is, I still can continue to be able to do things that Igor Stravinsky could not do. And I mean, just bear with me and you'll see what I'm saying. When a new symphonic piece is written, it may not be rehearsed for another 2 to 3 months. And then when it is, sometimes you get if you're a big name, you'll get a 6-hour rehearsal. If you're a smaller name, you get a 3-hour rehearsal. I have been able to write music finishing at about 4 a.m. and at 8 a.m. at Fox Studios, the best musicians in the world, play it back to me. Now, Is that a fantastic reward? I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
And so with my band, I'm able to write anything. And I'm my own best critic. If I don't like it, I say, pass it in, guys. I tear it up and we throw it away. Except that's a little bit of a white lie, because when I say throw it away, I mean throw that piece of paper away. However, in the computer, it's still there. I can go back and tinker with it and make it the way I want it. So hence, now we get to Try a Little Tenderness.
I have to, I'm so sorry. I have to interrupt really quickly.
Absolutely.
What you're talking about, what you were saying about Try a Little Tenderness, a song from the 30s, a couple of different artists did their versions of it, and how things changed, what you're talking about, arrangements, composing. That's so interesting to me because I just last week I watched the Beach Boys, The Making of Pet Sounds. All right,
no kidding.
One of the biggest albums, and this is amazing to me. Their song, they had a hit song called "The Sloop John B," which is one of my favorite Beach Boys songs, right?
And that's a very old song.
It is. I had no idea. I had no idea. Yeah. But you know, the Beach Boys, they were surf band. They were surf music. They had a particular sound, and this song was theirs. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it was theirs. Well, during this documentary, yeah, it's unbelievable. During this documentary, they talked that song was originally done by the Kingston Trio, and they played a snippet of it. Sounds nothing like the Beach Boys version of Sloop John B. Nothing. And I was floored. I was absolutely floored that you could take a song that somebody else did. It sounds nothing like it. It's the same words and it's the same melody, but it's completely different. That's what you're talking about, right, Peter?
Absolutely. And now, to me, my favorite example of this kind of thing, and it's something I bring up when I'm giving educational seminars, that kind of thing, is there was when you said folk group, my brain kicked in right away. There was a folk group called the Weavers. And they had a song called "It's a Very Good Year," and I defy you to recognize it once you hear their version, because everybody knows this Sinatra version, which was just incredible. And his arranger was a wonderful, wonderful musician called Gordon Jenkins. He did this operatic version of it, which was just superb, absolutely. Now, Frank always had plenty to say about what he wanted in the arrangements. It wasn't like Gordon just went away and just did it and figured, I hope Frank likes it. Sinatra always was involved musically. He was such a brilliant musician that he'd say, I don't, in his New Jersey dialect, I won't try and say it, but he would say, do it like this and do it like that. And so, as I say, if you heard the original version by the Weavers, you go, that's not It's a Very Good Year. That's something else.
Right? Yes. Yes, yes.
So I understand what you're saying, Jackie, about the Sloop John B., because as an original song, I think that it's a folk song from the West Indies, the Bahamas, I think. I think that's where it originated.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so anyway, I'll quickly finish up for you on Try Little Tenderness. I'll finish up for you on that. Yeah. So once I formed the jazz orchestra, you go through changes with players. You know, some guys are not available, and then some guys seem to be doing a terrific job. Well, I heard this saxophone player by the name of Ricky Woodard. I heard him play in a joint in Beverly Hills, and I said, man, I wonder if he'd be available to play in my band, and he was very enthused to do it. Now, Ricky had traveled with Ray Charles for like 8 years, and he's a star. So I asked him once, I said, Ricky, if I want to do a ballad for you, have anything in mind? And he said, no, anything you like. And I just, something, a light went on, something popped in my brain. I said, you know what? Could be this. And the rest is history, because it turned out great. The arrangement to me is like, it's a superb frame around a Picasso. And that's what you try to do. You try to, for a soloist like Ricky, you try to lay it out with which it's, in other words, it's still Try a Little Tenderness, but you do it in such a way that it, you know, it has a nice build to it. And the audience, I mean, this is a showstopper for us. We did the jazz festival and back in May at the LAX, one of the hotels there. And Ricky got a standing ovation for that. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. Now, there's two things I want to say about this piece. One is, you know, first of all, what a great illustration, what a great metaphor. It's like a beautiful frame for a Picasso, right? Is that how you view arrangement? Because you've got the notes on the page, It's a song, but you get in, you make it different depending on the sections you've got, the musicians that show up that night, whatever is going on. How do you view orchestration?
Well, you want to buy my book? No, it's a joke.
That's a joke.
That's a joke. No, I would say my view of orchestration has grown over the years based on what I've heard other people do and the mistakes I've made in the past. And so as if you have any self-worth, you begin improving all the time. You learn more. It's always a learning process. And as far as the instrumentation, I knew pretty well what it should be. And it was then just a question of tailoring it. It's hard to at a certain point, it's very difficult to describe music. It's much easier for me to write it down than it is for me to describe it. But I would say it focused because I treated it for Ricky as a saxophone soloist. I treated him as a vocalist. So that I was almost writing a vocal background, as though somebody had asked me to do a newer version of, another version of Try a Little Tenderness, only for, and that's the way I treated it. I treated Ricky's part as a vocal part.
Well,
wow.
Jackie,
Are we going to listen to it?
Let's hear it. The Peter Myers Orchestra, Try a Little Tenderness. Ricky Woodard on tenor sax. Thank you. Now, Peter, the one thing that people listening can't see, this is on YouTube. If you search Peter Myers Orchestra, Try a Little Tenderness, the one thing that people can't see is that the crowd loved it, no doubt, but the musicians are clapping.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like every now and again you come up with one that's got the magic. And there's no question that one has the magic. And by the way, you know, as wonderful as Ricky plays a fabulous solo on it, one of the other keys to getting that to be performed the way it is the drummer. In the first portion, he has to be very subdued. And then he has to crank it up. So we get to the real, you know, where you feel your heartbeat going. And Mel Lee is just a fabulous drummer for what I'm doing. Is just, he can't be beat. It's intuitive. He and I rarely have a conversation about anything in the music. The only time I talk to him is when I don't like something, I'd say, Mel, not like that. Do it more like this. But in that particular rendition that we did then, Mel's playing is superb. It really is.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. Now,
but
now
you're right.
I'm
sorry. The other musicians, they know when it's a great performance, and you know, they've all got smiles on their faces, you know, which is great. I mean, I love every minute of it.
I mean, that harkens back to what I was saying. Now that we're present day, we're talking about the fabulous Peter Myers Orchestra today at Peter. Yeah. MyersOrchestra.com. The mission of the Peter Myers Orchestra is for the preservation of American music through public concert performances, educational seminars, and commercial recordings. That's what you're doing today. And
yes.
Tell us about that. Tell us about that mission.
Well, where do I start? I would say, as much as anything, the music that we have, that I've written in the book, I mean, we cover so many areas of American music. And we're at a stage now where a lot of this music could go away. There are some wonderful jazz composers whose music is really, really good. And it's not that I'm trying to say nothing today is any good. I'm not saying that at all, but I'm just saying I want to, through my orchestra, is to preserve the memory of this kind of thing. And the best way I can compare it is like, because I have a lot of symphonic experience, by the way. And so with a symphony orchestra, you can go downtown to hear the LA Philharmonic or hear a guest symphony orchestra. You can go downtown to the Disney Hall and you may hear a Mozart piece, and then after that they'll play a piece by Gustav Mahler, and then something by Dmitri Shostakovich, which means that you can it's always possible to hear, and probable to hear at a symphonic concert, music which was written centuries apart. You can hear a Bach piece that was written in the late 1600s, and you can play and hear alongside it a piece by John Adams, which was written last week. And to me, I feel in the jazz in a jazz field, it should be just the same way. And that's what our little way of going at it is that. If you permit me, I will also say that I'm going to describe one particular piece that I wrote for the band. And it just about sums up. I do what they call mashups, which I enjoy doing. And this one particular piece, I call it Three Trios. And it's three different songs from different eras. It begins with a Duke Ellington piece written in 1928 called Creole Love Call. It's followed then by a piece written by Thelonious Monk in the, I guess, late 40s called Blue Monk. And then it pays off with a piece by Miles Davis called Freddie Freeloader. And the essence, the similarities are amazing because it's what we call trio writing. I'm not going to get too technical, but it means three. There are three voices in there. Now, where does that come from? Where it comes from is probably gospel singing. I'm not giving a lecture. I'm just being informative. I think it was the University of Tennessee, I think, back in the late 1800s, was a group called the Jubilee Singers, and they sang black church music. And it was this form of singing. It wasn't done in four-part harmony like Western European church music was. This was done with all done with voices. And so this trio writing, that's one of the and I'm sort of rambling a bit, but the trio writing is such that I figured I could put a piece together, and it's one of the most popular ones that we play because people and the audience then, I'm not giving them a lecture, but they begin to sense the similarities of the music, and it's all wonderful music, and that's therefore the preservation. And we do Michael Jackson, you know, it's just, that's the idea. But and I should say, but we do it our way. In other words, that's the key.
I know exactly what he's talking about, Joe. I don't know if you ever are you familiar with mashups like today? What DJs and engineers are doing today with mashups?
Right, we had someone on. Remember?
Yes. Was that Amani? Was that Amani that talked about that Amani Rock? Yeah. I'm curious, Peter. How long ago were you doing these mashups?
Probably just when I started this band. I wanted to do something contemporary, and the answer to your question is, I would say about 3.5 years ago.
Okay, all right, yeah, because I only discovered mashups maybe, I don't know, 8, 10 years ago. If I don't even think it's that long, maybe 7 or 8 years ago.
I don't know.
And basically what they do, and I have a whole bunch of them. I downloaded a whole bunch of them where they'll take a Led Zeppelin song, and while that song is playing, they insert, say, a rap musician song. But they have this. I'm not a musician, Peter. I know nothing about it, so I don't know. I don't know the technical terms, but they have the same beat or the same count or rhythm.
Jackie, you're absolutely right. That's what it is. You've got the essence of it. But you see, you're the perfect audience because you don't know the terminology, but you recognize your instinct. You recognize the music, and you go, yeah, that's right. You get the feel of it. And that's what we try to do is to reach an audience. You try to reach the audience. The first mashup we did was I wanted to do something more contemporary. You know, I said, okay, let's – and I listened to a lot of things, and I caught this Michael Jackson tune from a few years ago called Billie Jean. And when I heard the bass line, I said, you know what? That's almost the same bass line that Henry Mancini wrote to Peter Gunn. So hence the first mashup is a combination of Billie Jean and Peter Gunn.
That's fabulous.
I have to say, when it comes to this, I'm dangerous because I've got this memory bank that goes back forever. And
You're right, Peter. They're doing it with Nina Simone. They're doing it with, you know, I mean, I know Nina Simone and Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett are all, you know, Sperry, you know, but they're doing it with even older music. It's amazing. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Okay, well, I've got one on the desk right now, on the drawing board, and it's going to be a combination of, let's see. Well, you'll get Pretty Woman, Roy Orbison, da da dee dee dee, and then the Beatles, do 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 do, no, do 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 dee da do da, you know that one, the Beatles, obla dee obla da, something.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then at twice the tempo is Pretty Woman, do 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 do. Okay, so that one's on the drawing board.
So. Now, what's amazing
Pretty
to me is that these musicians and engineers that are doing the mashups that I'm downloading from YouTube and other places, they're doing all that on computers. You are doing it live?
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, absolutely, sure. In other words, I work it out. I mean, sometimes what seems like a great idea turns out to be not such a great idea, and I'm the best judge of that. But say, for instance, you know, the Michael Jackson, Henry Mancini combination, I began working on it, and I move things up now. One of the things that is available to us now, where we used to write all this stuff in pencil on score paper, I sketch out in the very briefest shorthand. Nobody else could figure it out what I'm doing. But then from there, I go to what's called a notation program in the computer. Well, one of the advantages there is you can take hunks like a 32-bar section, and you can move it from here to over there and back and that kind of thing, which makes it, you know,
right.
I'm still creating, but the methodology is much, much easier than it used to be, I must say.
Right.
And
What's your favorite software? What's your favorite software?
Am I allowed to advertise?
Working with music. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I would say.
You're a teaching professor.
Well, yeah, I would say Sibelius is what I like. That's my favorite notation software. The thing for somebody like myself, who I'm not a computer programmer, but I'm pretty computer savvy, but it has to work for me. I don't need to know everything that it does because I won't use it all. It's the number of applications that I want to be able to access. If it's in the program, then I'll love it. And I would say back probably in the early 80s, I, along with two other composers, who are terrific guys, we started getting into the idea of putting the stuff in the computer. And the first software we used, it was typical in that it would give you 10 ways to get from A to B, and then nothing to get from B to C. So we were sort of like guinea pigs. We told them, you've got overkill over here, and you've got a black hole over here. So, and so we were sort of in the early days. We were not computer engineers. No, make no mistake about that.
Mm.
But we did help in some of the software companies in improving their product, and so I became pretty computer savvy. I'm not making a study of computers. I would go crazy.
Right.
But you asked the question, which is one of my favorites. I'd say Sibelius, the notation software. It's terrific.
I asked the question, and I have to say to everyone out there who's young and who's a musician or wannabe musician, you should check out Sibelius. It's from Avid. A company that's well known to the video editing community, avid.com/Sibelius, Sibelius, avid.com/Sibelius. And it looks fabulous.
It is. It really is. And if the young guys can afford it, get a big monitor, a big wide monitor.
Yeah.
And then set yourself up to have split screen. It makes it easier. I mean, for instance, I'll give you a perfect example of why I'm suggesting what I'm suggesting to the younger guys. You get a reasonably powerful computer, you get Sibelius, and then access this maybe you can find them on the internet, a split screen software. And then let's say, for instance, I'm working on one piece and I put it on the left-hand side of the screen and the second piece on the right-hand side of the screen. And I can, if I want to take portions of music from the left-hand side, I can just drag it and drag it over there. It is so quick to do it.
Wow.
I mean, it really, really is.
Wow.
It's fantastic. It really is. It doesn't make you creative. It just makes you productive. Oh, I like that. I should write that one down. It doesn't make you creative, but it does make you productive. I should
That's
put
in
that
the
in
next
a golden
commercial.
Book.
Yeah.
We're Joe, we're getting a mass class here.
We are. We are. And I don't think we really needed a station break. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the South Bay Show, and we're talking with Peter Myers from the Peter Myers Orchestra. If you want to know more about the Peter Myers Orchestra, just go to PeterMyersOrchestra.com, and you can find out everything about the news, the personnel, some pictures, some videos. But, of course, the big news is they have a show coming up at the Lighthouse July 16th. This coming Sunday, yes?
That's
yes,
correct.
Yes.
11 a.m., it's a brunch-type program. We'll be playing all our best stuff, especially the stuff you can pat your foot to.
Wow.
You know, that's my kind of Sunday. Sunday brunch
yeah.
at the Lighthouse on Pier Avenue, listening to the fabulous Peter Myers Orchestra. I love that. I love that. I think I have to go.
Thank you so much, Jackie. And by the way, thank you both of you for having me on the show. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, I have to give props to my friend Doug, who contacted me. Joe, I don't know if you're familiar with Doug, but he's the one that hooked us up with the El Segundo School of Music. We've had them on a couple. Mm-hmm. They do a bunch of great shows all throughout the South Bay during the year, and he hooked me up with them a couple of years ago, and he contacted me last week and was telling me that he's working with Peter now, and you know, it's kismet. You know, he's like, he's playing this Sunday. Is there any way you can get him on the show this week? And we had a cancellation, and it worked out, and life is good.
Life is good. Peter,
right.
It's been a pleasure. We definitely have to we want to have you on when your second book, the lives and the lives of the rich and famous and the royals. We want to have you on when your second book is published. That's going to be fabulous.
Buckingham Palace.
Were you in the Royal Grenadiers band?
Yes.
That
as a 17-year-old.
That's a great story.
As I say, on the public airwaves, no. That has to be done in a drawing room somewhere.
I love it. I love it. All right, we got to wrap it up, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Peter, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. I've had a great time.
And, of course, thank you, Jackie.
Always a pleasure, Joe.
We'll see you tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know, Jackie, who's our guest tomorrow?
Our guest for yesterday canceled at the last minute. I'm waiting to hear from our producer.
Okay. Well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye now.